In today's interview, I am delighted to be joined by Gabriel Sachs, Investment Director for Asia and Emerging Market Equities at Aberdeen. Gabriel started his career with Aberdeen in 2008 as a research analyst and portfolio manager, working on a range of emerging market equity funds, including a frontier market strategy. Today, his primary responsibility is as lead manager on the Aberdeen Asia Focus Investment Trust, a company focused on offering investors exposure to a portfolio of high quality, smaller companies across Asia that are otherwise very difficult for investors to get access to. He is also part of Aberdeen's broader emerging market equity team and is involved in other EM strategies, including an emerging markets income strategy. Welcome to the podcast, Gabriel, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, pleasure to be here.
So can we start by you telling us a little bit about your career history?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in the same firm since graduating from university 17 years ago now. So I started as a 21-year-old in the emerging markets team at Aberdeen. I actually did an internship in the summer of 2008 and was fortunate enough to get a job just before the financial crisis. And I suppose it's just been a really good place to learn and develop as a fund manager, because we were all generalists at the time and we spent a lot of time meeting companies across the emerging market space, and therefore got involved in lots of different products and, you know, researched a lot of different countries and sectors. I started probably more on the ex-Asian side, and then after about 10 years in London, moved to Singapore for 5 years and focused more on Asia, and then moved back to London about 3 years ago. So at the moment, I'm primarily focused on smaller companies in Asia. I run an Asian smaller companies investment trust called Aberdeen Asia Focus, but also involved in a couple of other emerging market portfolios.
Just a bit more color around the Asia Focus Trust. Can you just briefly explain the focus of the fund? You've referenced already emphasis to more smaller cap companies, and it excludes Japan as well. So just interested in the focus.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the trust celebrates 30 years this year. And, you know, I think with the emergence of emerging markets, as it were, you know, Japan was already quite a well-established developed market. It rose to developed market status earlier than lots of other Asian nations. So I think a lot of people allocate to Japan separately and focus on Asia ex Japan. A couple of years ago, we actually also excluded Australia or Australasia from our focus as well. But yeah, the idea of the trust 30 years ago was to give people access to a broader set of companies in Asia that are really hard to access for UK investors. And I think that remains very true today, where it's such a large universe of companies that we can choose from. And actually lots of other funds are quite samey in the sense that, you know, they have all the large cap, the typical large cap names in the portfolio, like a Tencent, TSMC, Alibaba, and very few of our holdings will be in other people's portfolios. So I think the relevance of the trust is still very much alive, I think, and with the growth in passive, remains very relevant today, in my view.
And you have co-managers on the fund. So talk to me a little bit about how you work together. Are they also based in London?
Yeah, so we have about 50 people across emerging markets. Our key offices are actually in London and Singapore. We do, outside of Asia, also have an office in Brazil, but most of our people, about of those 50, 35 to 40, are out in Asia. So we have a very large team whose job is really to meet companies day in, day out. So, you know, this trust was, and actually our team was set up by a gentleman called Hugh Young, who retired relatively recently. But we really leveraged the team. And Flavia has been head of equities in Asia for quite some time. She's actually retiring at the end of the year. And Sinyao, who's based in Singapore with Flavia, you know, helps to co-manage the fund with me. But, you know, most of the London office is managing emerging market portfolios. And in Singapore, they're managing the Asian portfolios. But we really work collaboratively as one team, as it were.
How concentrated is your portfolio, and do you have a typical holding period for stocks?
Yeah, I think I would say it's relatively concentrated. We have between 50 and 60 stocks, so you know, average of about 2% weight in each company. And given in the small cap space, particularly, there isn't any single stock that's over sort of 50 basis points of the benchmark. So this is a very active strategy. The active share, it's a measure of how active we are, is 96%. So we're very, very different even from the small cap benchmark. Holding periods, you know, when we buy a company, we don't really think about when we're going to sell it. We'd like, you know, we have companies in the portfolio actually that have been in the portfolio for over 20, 25 years, but they're becoming few and far between. I think a typical holding period would probably be 3 to 5 years. But markets have been very volatile, and therefore I think our holding periods have dropped a little bit versus the past.
You're looking for when you're selecting stocks to invest in, and if you're sector agnostic, how do you go about selecting stocks within the portfolio?
Yeah, it's a very good question. You know, our key philosophy centers around quality, so we want to buy the best businesses we can find in our space, either a particular country or a sector. You know, as I said, we have a very wide opportunity set. So we're really looking for companies, A, with good governance and management teams, B, strong industry positions, and three, you know, a healthy balance sheet. So not very indebted companies. Those are the key three things we look at from a quality perspective. And then we go to look at valuations. We try not to get too bogged down on the value versus growth debate. We want growth at the cheapest possible price. And yeah, I think macro is something that we've had to pay more and more attention to over the years. You can't really ignore politics and macro in emerging markets. We tend to think about that quite a lot. It doesn't drive our portfolio positioning, but you know, it does help us color. You know, if we've got enough in India, you know, we'll look elsewhere for opportunities. And obviously, we use the benchmark as a reference point, but we're happy to deviate from that benchmark if we have a view on that country from a macro point of view.
You touched on briefly politics, and this isn't the focus of the podcast, but I'm interested, we're recording in August 2025. How much time have you spent this year focusing on tariffs and the impact on the markets you focus on and the companies within that?
Yeah, well, it's very topical. You know, yesterday Trump did slap 50% tariffs on India and 100% tariffs on chips, which come primarily from Taiwan. And we were actually doing some trades in India and Taiwan, wondering what the impact would be today. And actually, particularly Taiwan, it's completely shrugged off the 100% tariffs on chips. And that's because, you know, the headlines are very kind of noisy. But actually, when you look at the detail, you know, the 100% tariffs only apply to companies that are not looking to invest in the US. And most of these chip makers are actually investing in the US and not actually producing yet. But the wording at least says, you know, as long as you're looking to invest and employ people in the US, it's fine. So actually, it won't really impact most of the companies, as far as we can tell at the moment. But certainly, geopolitics has become a factor that moves markets. April, you saw a very large drawdown in the Liberation Day, but recently you've seen markets become quite desensitized to all this tariff news, which is interesting. I think maybe markets are being a little bit complacent, and certainly we need to look at the impact of tariffs on specific sectors, countries, and businesses. But it hasn't, you know, we haven't churned the portfolio much as a result of that. You know, it's just part of our assessment of risk for businesses. And ultimately, in my view, tariffs are really bad for global growth, and particularly bad for inflation in the US. I don't think it does anyone any favors, but, you know, so we will be impacted indirectly if growth slows, which likely it will slow a little bit. I don't want to elaborate too much. We can go on forever on this topic, but we're still quite sanguine that, you know, most of our companies in the portfolio are driven by domestic growth in Asia and therefore less impacted by the tariffs.
Just across the markets you cover, what is the IPO outlook like? Because obviously it's been very challenged for it, the UK and London Stock Exchange. Interested in what's going on in the markets you cover.
Yeah, so there's a very broad spectrum, I would say. I think India is at a very kind of active end. If you look at 2024, I won't get the number 100% accurate, but 20 to 25% of all global IPOs were in India last year. So extremely active market. You know, the Indian equity markets have probably outpaced the S&P over, you know, a 3 to 5 year period, which is quite extraordinary. But, you know, so it's the proper bull market has happened in India, and you know, a lot of activity in the IPO space there. China, it has slowed considerably, but you still see quite a few listings in Hong Kong. Companies that listed in the US doing a dual listing or converting their primary listing to Hong Kong for geopolitical reasons or otherwise. But also it's a market that continues to have IPOs just given the sheer size of it. And then you have at the other end of the spectrum, you know, Southeast Asia has been pretty quiet. You know, not a lot of domestic investor activity or support there. So it relies a bit more on foreign investors. And so there, it's been a bit quiet. So it's very mixed, I would say. But, you know, I think companies are in good shape. I don't think it's dropped off as much as it has in places like London and elsewhere.
The challenge in London's been significant outflows from UK funds and therefore less capital to deploy when there's plenty of upside for less risky listed investment opportunities. Have you been affected by fund outflows at all?
Look, I think as a firm, we've seen a fair share of outflows. You know, we are very geared to emerging markets and Asia as a fund house, and probably one of the largest 10 years ago. And so EM and Asia haven't been an asset class that's been in favor. It's been a lot about the US, and you've seen huge concentration in equity markets, right? 70% of global equity markets are now US, and about 14 is the Mag 7. So that's, you know, very high concentration. You've also at the same time seen the rise of passive. So it hasn't been an easy backdrop. And I think it's been tough to raise assets in emerging markets. But we know we have pockets of strength in products where we have seen inflows. But generally it's been difficult. And I think people have been a bit risk off as well post-COVID. You might not look that way recently because markets have been quite strong, but beyond, you know, prior to this year, I think it's been a bit challenging. Yeah, I guess with the trust, we benefit from being closed end. So actually there, that structure has been quite helpful to give us a fixed pool of capital to invest in smaller companies in Asia.
And let's chat a little bit more about Asian equities more broadly. I mean, you've got a huge universe of small cap companies to invest in. And you mentioned quite a large team across Aberdeen. So talk to me about how you screen companies and how you work with the broader team across the UK and Singapore.
Yeah, that's a great question. We, as I said, you know, we're very well resourced. And I think we think it's important given we want to be close to our companies and we spend a lot of time meeting them face to face. We think that is the best way to invest. You know, you can always sit behind the screen and look at numbers and, you know, have quantitative analysis, but ultimately businesses are still run by people. And I think getting an understanding of what they're thinking with regard to strategy, how they approach things, it is still very important. That breadth of team is important and being close to a company is important. Having said that, we obviously want to be as efficient as possible and do more with less. So we are trying to incorporate more screening. We are leveraging also success that our global small cap guys have had in Edinburgh with, you know, 6-7 people managing global small cap funds with a small team. They've been able to leverage this tool called the Matrix, which helps to screen and actively dynamically sort of score companies. So we're trying to leverage things like that and also be more focused on covering companies from a sector point of view, which allows us to have more cross collaboration between, you know, developed markets, people sitting looking at Europe or the US. And Asia and emerging markets, where obviously from a sector point of view, what's happening with AI in the US is very relevant for the Taiwanese, Korean companies we invest in.
You talked about a matrix system you use for screening, and you just touched on AI from your perspective, I guess, looking at how companies are adopting AI. But how do you think AI might shift the buy side or investment management over the next few years?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's definitely helping from a productivity point of view. So, you know, one of the challenges is just distilling a lot of information. And we have been using tools in aggregating all the sell-side research and actually doing generative AI searches on and comparisons between stocks and sectors and countries, which is, you know, it just helps you instead of you having to pick out all that information from lots of different sources. It does that very quickly for you. So that's been pretty helpful. And there are other tools out there that we're experimenting with that should help on the productivity side. I think thinking very long term, you know, there is a risk that we're all replaced by, I wouldn't say robots, but just AI who can predict how markets will perform. I think we're still quite a way away from that. But we obviously need to be very cognizant of the fact that, you know, as humans, we're not maybe the most efficient, and yeah, we can do better. So it is, I think people will incorporate in different ways. Obviously, there's also very different investment styles out there. You know, I think more quantitative, high turnover strategies might use AI more frequently than a long only buy side firm.
And how much, I mean, just more broadly, how much do you still use the sell side? You've already touched on less relevant to small caps, which are poorly researched, particularly across Asian equities. Are you working with global investment banks? Tell me a little bit about the sell side analysts you interact with.
Yeah, I would say historically, we use them very little. And I think they're not the first port of call because we have a big team to do the due diligence ourselves. We spend most of our time doing our own research. But obviously, we do rely on it to generate new ideas, to help us spot things that we haven't seen. And, you know, there's generally some great analysts out there who are sector specialists in what they do. So I think it varies by analyst as we're becoming more sector focused, as, you know, we split a bit our portfolio management responsibilities and analyst responsibilities. And as sector analysts, people will probably rely more and have more conversations with individual analysts in those sectors. So we definitely use it. You know, it's a great resource. But I would say that our focus is on doing the job ourselves first, and then using sell side to complement our analysis.
And every fund manager I speak to doesn't rely on forecasts and, well, valuation. They form their own assumptions. Do you look at consensus data? Do you find it easy to access reliable consensus data on the companies that you're screening?
Yeah, no, we definitely look at consensus, and I think it's been fine. You know, occasionally there's some glitches, and, you know, we always need to cross check, but yeah, we do use consensus, and, you know, we use that as a gauge against our own forecasts. So, we give analysts the flexibility to, value companies as they think is most appropriate for that business. And then we can peer review, because we have, again, a large team. Once a stock is initiated, we can peer review that initiation and play devil's advocate or challenge that that investment thesis. But certainly, you know, on an ongoing basis as well, we need to keep an eye on how the company is performing against market expectations. It's become very important to meet, you know, expectations or have a non-consensus view, and therefore, or it has always been important. So therefore, you know, it is crucial for us as well. I think it's fine. We have, you know, access via Bloomberg primarily to consensus earnings.
Let's touch a little bit on your interaction with companies. And my first question is actually, as a manager behind an investment trust, are you involved in the investor relations for the investment trust yourself? I had a look on your website. You've got a very helpful sort of video explaining your sort of current thinking. Just tell me a little bit first about how you're involved in the IR for your own investment trust.
Yeah, so I do. You know, the investment trust space has been under a bit of pressure in terms of the discounts that it trades on versus net asset value, and therefore I think boards have been incredibly focused on trying to sell the story and get the message out there of the benefits of investment trusts, and obviously the individual approaches that each trust has. So yeah, I've been very involved in attending events, conferences to present to shareholders, also meeting wealth managers and institutional clients across the UK. Doing more digitally as well, I think, has been a focus. So doing short videos and podcasts, which I think, a bite-sized way is quite helpful to, people might not want to sit there for an hour to see you speak, which sometimes what we do is can be a bit dry. So if you can just say, this is what's happening in Asia, this is what we've been doing in 5-10 minutes, has been quite helpful. And we're seeing interest pick up. I think whether it's market driven, people are getting a bit more comfortable. Our performance has been good, so I think maybe that also drives a bit more interest. But whatever it is, I think you need to be active to make sure that you survive in this world where I think a lot of flows have been driven by the platforms to more ETFs and mutual funds. So the investment trusts are great, great investment vehicles, and I think we need to be as an industry doing more to promote it.
Do you have any interaction with the private investors, retail investors?
Yes, we do. So that's primarily through these sort of larger speaking events where the AIC or platforms like AJ Bell or Shares Magazine, they'll set up conferences where there's different speakers, and you have 100, sometimes more, sometimes less, of people, retail investors coming in. And actually, I think that those are some of the best experiences in presenting, because you get some very different questions and people that have been investing for their own PA portfolios for many years, and they do their own homework and they come to the AGM. We do also host an AGM typically at the office where we present and offer some drinks and lunch. I think it's a very important part of trying to gain more retail interest, rather than also just rely on the big investors. I think it will be it's a focus for us to try and get more retail investors on the shareholder base.
And then coming back to the IR that you're interacting with in your portfolio companies, are there big differences between some of the countries you cover across Asia? So, for example, between China, India, etc.
Yeah, there's a huge difference. It's crazy. So I would say that across the emerging markets piece, there's differences in terms of access, language barriers, governance structures, and culture. So all of that plays a part. So, I'm originally from Brazil, and I would say, the Brazilians are more dramatic. So when they're optimistic, they're mostly optimistic, but they're always quite optimistic and sell you a good story. And actually, normally they're very good management teams, but the macro and the politics tends to let things down sometimes. Whereas, other countries, people are much more conservative. Maybe the Taiwanese are very kind of softly spoken, conservative, tend not to guide too aggressively. India would probably be on the more Brazil camp. But beyond the cultural differences, I think access to management is an important one. So I would say that maybe because of language barriers, but also because of the way that corporate culture has evolved, you don't get access to CEOs, CFOs as often in places like China and Korea compared to India. India has a very rich equity culture. I think the Bombay Stock Exchange was one of the earliest stock exchange globally, not just in emerging markets. And it's a very healthy private sector. So they've always relied on the equity markets and respect the equity markets. Whereas I think it's actually more of a new thing in a country like China, where it's been historically more centralized and driven by the government. And access to management is a challenge. And then on top of that, you have the language barrier. So I would say China and Korea, from my perspective, and this is limited to me because of my language, perhaps, but those are the tougher markets, I think, to have good transparency, particularly at the small cap level. Once you get to large cap companies, they typically professionalize and have a proper IR team that speaks English. But at the small cap level, you know, sometimes, you know, you never get to meet the CEO, which is a shame. And sometimes you don't need to meet the CFO and the CEO. It's not critical. But I think having that accessibility always helps give you confidence and conviction when investing.
And how do you overcome the language barrier? I'm assuming you've got a multilingual team. You mentioned Brazil. You're from Brazil originally. But if it's a management team that don't speak English, is that a situation you come across?
Yeah, so certainly having a diverse team helps. So, you know, when it comes to China, we have 10 people out in China between Hong Kong and Shanghai. We manage country funds in China. So, you know, it's not crucial, but it really is helpful to have people. And our team in China itself is quite diverse from different regions in China. And therefore, you know, that gives us very good perspective, good insight. Good cultural sensitivities as well, which is always, I think, at the margin, very helpful to build a fuller picture of what you're investing in. But, you know, I think, you know, a lot of companies do a good job and also present things quite well and are helpful from an investor relations perspective. So I don't want to generalize too much. But yeah, having a team that speaks the languages is definitely helpful. And that's why we have teams on the ground as well.
What would a good meeting with a management team or IR team look like to you?
It's a good question. So it comes in, you know, I think one of the best meetings are sometimes when you've never met a company. And sometimes actually when you know, we like to prepare very thoroughly for companies. But I think when you are, it's an introductory meeting, there's not a lot of information out there. And the management or IR just relay the business strategy and narrative in a very clear manner and addresses points like competition, industry, position, you know, the outlook for growth and profitability, key risks. There are management teams that are just incredibly capable of thinking about a business holistically, and it just makes your job very easy. You know, those are some of the best meetings, but I think it's a combination of confidence, humility from management teams, but also relaying a narrative that you can, you know, you'd be happy to be on a journey with that business, even if there is some ups and downs, which invariably there are. Obviously, when it's a business that you already own, then, you know, having management teams that are quite clear on milestones to keep track of, quite clear on why things might have gone wrong and just very transparent. I think investors appreciate transparency. You know, we're used to getting bad news as well, but I think when there's a bit of opaqueness, it never helps.
Do you get many opportunities to provide feedback either directly to the company or the management team or through advisors to the company?
Yeah, absolutely. So sometimes if it's a deal, we go through the bankers to express our view on whether we like the company, you know, at what price we might participate. But in generally with our companies, we have a strong partnership. You know, we're long-term investors. And, you know, for many years, we actually attended AGMs of these companies just to make our presence known. But we are in constant dialogue, essentially. Obviously, when things really go wrong and it has to be a bit more forceful, we tend to send letters to the board or the promoters of the companies. And actually, you know, the good companies are always quite receptive and open to debating these issues. Occasionally, we also have to sort of nudge companies to disclose more. You know, in an age of increasing ESG requirements, sometimes companies are doing more than what they're saying they're doing. So, you know, we try and encourage companies to do an ESG report or at least disclose what they've been doing.
How do you like to access information about a company outside of meetings? Do you rely heavily on websites, materials that the companies produce?
Yeah, look, the company website is super important. We do look at annual reports, financials, company presentations are obviously really helpful. to get behind the numbers as well and provide more context. In a, you know, charts are always really helpful to build a visual. I quite like visuals to help me kind of think about an investment case. But obviously, sell side helps as well from that perspective. And yeah, I think you have to build a picture with all the material you can get access to. So you know, depending on how close you are to the company and how much you need to do in terms of forecasting, you know, some companies are quite helpful in providing deeper financial analysis in breakdowns of different divisions, particularly if it's a conglomerate or you have a broader group. That tends to be really helpful.
As we start to wrap up the conversation, recording this in August 25, what's your outlook for the remainder of the year?
I think I referenced this at the start, where I think markets might have become a little bit complacent to bad news. I think the US economy has been quite resilient, but I do worry that maybe second half will be a little bit more challenging. Having said that, you know, I think from where we sit in Asia, inflation isn't really a problem. You know, rates are likely to start to come down in the US, and actually rates in Asia have already, and emerging markets have already been starting to get cut, which is supportive for growth. You know, growth in Asia is still very strong. You know, countries that we invest in, like India, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, they're all growing 5% plus GDP. And therefore, actually, the backdrop is still very healthy, and the companies are very, very healthy. So we remain very optimistic about the long term, but obviously predicting the short term is difficult. And, you know, I would hesitate to try and guess where we'd go. But I think one of the things that hopefully we see from a selfish point of view is a bit more allocation outside the US. I think investors haven't been as diversified as they should be. And, you know, Asia and EM is a really big part of the world with lots of growth and lots of opportunity. So hopefully see a bit more balanced flows in future as potentially, you know, US exceptionalism starts to peak. But I'll stop there.
And our audience for this podcast is global, it's listed companies, so mainly management teams and lots of IR professionals. So what's your key advice for that audience when they're speaking to investors like yourself?
Yeah, I think trying to create a narrative, not a fanciful one that's, you know, not grounded on reality, but, you know, trying to bring investors on a journey and explain, you know, the history, where you come from, what the vision is, and where you're going, and why, you know, being invested in that business is going to be fruitful, and why the company is differentiated. I think we're always looking for companies that have, you know, sustainable competitive position. So if you're able to express that, or say why you can get to a position where you'll be in that place, that's really helpful and kind of probably stops people from looking at the very, very short term, which I think is what markets have become incredibly driven by, you know, the next earnings. And I think we prefer, and might be, again, our perspective as a long only manager, but we like to be thinking about the long term strategy, you know, over a 3-5 year period, not the next quarter. You know, it doesn't really matter too much.
It's a common piece of feedback, actually, that to balance the short-term disclosure, which satisfies a certain cohort of investors,
yeah,
with the longer-term vision of the business. And it's hard to get that balance right, but an important one, I think, for everyone to consider in their presentations.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, you do have to different shareholder groups within the company, right? So, you know, I'm talking from one perspective, but you also need to be able to explain the short-term numbers. And there, I would say, you know, I think having clarity on the numbers is important, and not being too ambitious on the short-term guidance, which, you know, often, you know, companies that don't meet guidance after a few rounds, you know, just get derated, and then it's quite hard to get re-rated again. So just, again, create a nice long-term narrative, but in the short term, maybe be a little bit more conservative on the guidance, or at least, you know, very transparent and clear about what you're communicating.
Finally, do you have any questions you'd like to ask me?
Well, given you speak to a lot of investors and practitioners, you know, from what you've heard, is there anything we could be doing better, whether it's with AI or in terms of our own process and approach, would be helpful if you have any thoughts. But
yeah, absolutely. I think any IR professional really values direct dialogue with the investors, and not just in formal meetings, particularly when your management team is there, but welcomes the opportunity to speak briefly on the phone, bottom out questions, to hear your feedback firsthand. And the feedback is actually really, really important to our professionals. And it's often helpful to bottom it out at the end of a meeting. But what we don't hear often is sometimes praise where something's been done well. So if there's been some new disclosure, it's helpful to hear if that was helpful to you as an investor, as well as hearing feedback on how you might be able to improve your sort of communication strategy. So not just the feedback on actually the business and its performance, but the feedback for IR professionals in particular around how they're communicating, whether it's good, how that compares maybe to peer group companies, and if they're doing things differently, is that better or worse? So getting that direct feedback, I think, is really helpful. And always an area where there can't really be enough sort of dialogue and feedback between IR professionals and fund managers.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, because I think fund managers are very prone to being critical, I think. And I think, as you say, you know, there's some great IRs doing fantastic jobs. And actually, as I said, you know, sometimes you don't need, if you have a very strong IR, you don't need access to management. You know, they're often quite, you know, better at communicating than the management team. So yeah, that's a good point. I'll bear that in mind, and hopefully be helpful to IR teams as well.
Right. Well, thank you very much for your time today. It was a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Pleasure. Great to chat today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Inquire, the Investor Relations podcast. I'm your host, Clara Melia. For more IR insights, please do follow Equatory on LinkedIn, and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so that you never miss an episode. Plus, if you're interested in featuring on this podcast or have any feedback, please email us at info@equatory.com. Once again, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.